The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Words from William F. Schultz. This is the mission of our faith, to teach the fragile art of hospitality, to revere both the critical mind and the generous heart, to prove that diversity need not mean divisiveness, and to witness to all that we must hold the whole world in our hands. Good morning again, and welcome to the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. I'm Cindy Westfall. It says Cynthia up there, but it's actually Cindy. You can call me Cindy, or you can call me Cynthia. Either one is good. And I'm very happy to see you here today, all of you. Whether you're joining us in person today or virtually through the miracle of technology, hello to our friends there. Help us all be our best selves. Thank you for joining us today. We are a religion based on relationship and right action. Only when we come together in community can we live our commitment to honor each other's beauty and dignity. Today, I'm introducing the service because I asked Reverend Andrew a question a few weeks ago. So if you don't want to be up here giving some words, don't ask a question. However, that being said, I asked, why are we named a fellowship and not a church or a temple or a congregation? Asking questions is good, and I actually encourage questions. It's a critical mind when you ask questions. But it might mean that the answer comes in a sermon form. So lucky for all of us, we get to learn together. So I Googled fellowship and I Googled church, and I'm actually really happy to be hearing from Reverend Andrew all about what fellowship means to us as a congregation and as a community. So we begin this time together this morning to do as do congregations, societies, churches, and fellowships across the country and around the globe by lighting our chalice, the symbol of our free and ever-evolving faith. Reverend Andrew will be lighting the chalice for us. Justice, Meaning, and Purpose by David Breeden. We light this chalice, remembering and honoring our own tradition and celebrating the rich diversity of traditions among us. May we remember that justice, meaning, and purpose live first in deeply listening to one another. And we'll light the peace lamp as well. May peace be with us.
And with all the people of the world.
Thank you, Cindy. I went formal, and that's why I put Cynthia up there. And if any of you ask me questions, be careful, because you may be up here too. Let us begin our time of worship by singing, gathering hymn. If you want a hymnal, something to hold on to, you read music, you like looking at the lyrics, you can't see this, they're in the back. You can get up at any time and grab a hymnal. It is number 347, Gather the Spirit. The lyrics will also be on the screen. If you please rise in body or in spirit, and if someone's behind you, just, you know, make sure they have space to see this, and you can always come forward. There's this big empty row. 347, Gather the Spirit. I have a question for all of you. Who is, let's see, when this light comes up, who's this person? Do any of you know who this is?
Captain Underpants.
Yeah, Captain Underpants. What? Captain Underpants in a sermon? Yeah, here, look, there he is. Okay, here's the next level. Who's the person next to him? Professor Poopy Pants. That was close. Professor Poopy Pants. I never thought I'd be saying these words in front of a church, but, you know, things happen. They are banned in some schools because of all this potty humor, right? And here's the book I'm talking about, Captain Underpants and the Perilous Plot of Professor Poopy Pants. So if you need to reference this, you can borrow that from me later. I thought I was going to have another book to reference about the history of Unitarianism, but that one I couldn't find on my shelf, so I found this one. So, but there's a reason I'm doing this, actually. I really like these books. They're silly, they're irreverent. I mean, I guess there's a lot of potty humor, if you couldn't guess that. But in this one specifically, the author, Dave Pilkey, talks about this man having a silly name, Professor Poopy Pants, and how he got made fun of. And the author, in his sort of afterword, says, "I thought it was terrible that growing up, kids would get made fun of because of their names." And so he tried to write this to be silly and joking, but also to say that we don't need to make fun of people because of their names. And so there's an activity in the book which we're going to do as a congregation. So if you next slide here, Professor Poopy Pants gets angry because people get upset with him. And so he forces everyone, he says, you all have to change your name. So I want you all to look at these charts and get your new silly name. So if you can't see, you feel free to come up. I mean, I've already, like, this is already chaos, but you may come forward. If you need to borrow the book, the charts are in the book. Your first letter of your first name tells you what your new first name is. So I would be, I'm Andrew, so I'm Stinky. And then the second chart, the first letter of your last name is the first part of your last name. And then the last letter of your last name is the second half of your new last name. So I'll take a moment, you look at it, you figure it out. Yeah, feel free to come forward, it's okay.
Wait, what was the second thing?
So, first name, beginning of last name, end of last name. If you need help, ask someone near you. I think we have some experts in the back. So I'll do Phil for, well, I'll do Phil Manos. Okay, so Phil starts with a P. So he's doofus. There's no offense. His last name is M. Banana ends with an S. Fanny. So doofus banana Fanny. So I could say good morning and welcome to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. My name is the Reverend Stinky Chucklebuns. So here's my question for you. And if you need to like have a copy to take home and study, that's okay, we can do this. But my question for you is, if you're Stinky Chucklebuns, what does that change about who you are? And we can have a conversation. Like, what does that change if your name is now, whatever Phil's was, Doofus? Like, what does that change about who you are? Did I hear someone say something?
A rose by any other
name. Nothing, a rose by, Jerry's, I don't know, maybe you've read what I'm saying later, but Jerry said a rose by any other name, or it changes nothing. It
changes your place in line.
It changes your place in line. So it may change some things, right? If we go alphabetically, you know, being a W, my wife was a C, last name before she got married and changed her name. That really changed where she is in line, yeah.
You might need to take a self-defense course.
You might need to take a self-defense course. So, jokingly, but people may treat you differently, right? I mean, if my name were Stinky, people would approach me differently than if my name is, for example, the same as a famous composer. It is. If you, so. Right? I mean, people treat me differently because of my name. I'm Andrew L. Weber, and that has not defined who I am, but people interact with me differently. What else? What else might be different or the same? Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, so some of these have more negative connotations. Some, I mean, Stinky, Doofus, like those are negative, and some are just silly. Oprah, I don't know, that is silly. I don't know, Oprah's up there. But some of them have more of a meaning that culture or society or our experiences have put on there, and that you could internalize that. And you could say, oh my gosh, I'm defined by this. Oh, am I really stinky, not just in name, but I have a smell or an odor to me? Yeah. Well, we're going to talk more about this, but this was our activity for today. And as we're talking about the importance, the value of names, and also the value of words, our recessional hymn, and I sometimes talk about this, I go back and forth. I put the lyrics back to their original on our slide because of this arose by any other name, right? If we say spirit of love or love of God, which is what we sometimes change right here, love of God, sometimes we change to spirit of love. How is that different? Is that the same thing? Is it different? And for all those artists here, we only have permission from the author to use her words. So balance that. So let us sing as our children go to their classrooms and we continue thinking and learning about names and power and meanings. Go now in peace, go now in peace. May the love of God surround you everywhere, everywhere. You may go. That's the book I thought I had on my bookshelf. Yeah, that's The Fellowship Movement, A Growth Strategy and Its Legacy, which maybe is more appropriate for ministry than this one. Still meaning to be had. Now, what I'm going to do actually, the title of the service, as you heard, comes from a conversation I had with Cindy here. And she's been attending for a few years now. It's not she's not a newcomer, but she recently asked me about the identity of our congregation and about the name, Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, or TPUUF, which is pronounced both T-Puff and T-Poof. I've heard both of those because there are two U's. There should be T-Poof. Or it could be T-Pain. I really like that one. Now, occasionally we have services about Thomas Paine and who that is, the person we are named after. And if you miss those Sundays or you want to revisit it, I suggest you ask Preston Lutweil or Mike Berkheimer, happy birthday, about Thomas Paine and who that is. And we have a library downstairs that you can look and research Thomas Paine, right? I mean, you can look up Wikipedia too, like Cindy did, about what is fellowship. Who is Thomas Paine? Why might we laud him and have our name for him? But the question remains, what's the F? And yeah, I did that on purpose, so like it sounds like, what the F? No, it's what's the F? What does it mean to be called a fellowship? And some Unitarian Universalist gatherings are called churches. Some are called societies, congregations. I mean, you can... Some don't have a descriptor at all, just First Unitarian, right? I mean, why are we a fellowship? What does that mean for our communal sense of identity? Now, asking questions is really helpful, right? I mean, it's part of why we come together. A community like this, where we have different people coming, we have different people staying, and for some longer-term members, we might have an understanding of what that F means. We know what being a fellowship means. We know why we might identify more with a fellowship and less with a, say, church. There's a catch, though, because each one of us who knows and has an understanding of what fellowship means for us, that person next to us may have a very different assured meaning of what a fellowship means. So, like, this is what a fellowship is. And, like, no, that's not at all what a fellowship means, right? So where do we go for clarity? Well, we can go to a dictionary. That's the classic speech preparing. Like, well, Rogers' dictionary says. Or we go to the historical use of the word. Or we can look at the lived reality of this community. What does it mean to be a fellowship? Because one word, as we saw with the hymn, one word can have a lot of baggage, right? That word can have a lot of baggage for us. And especially when it's a label for such a varied community as we are here. So I'm going to start our exploration of this identity and the name with some Unitarian Universalist history. And in July, if you were here, we talked about some of our religious history going back to the 16th century in Transylvania. Today I'm going to bring it a little bit closer to home, so the mid-20th century in the United States, which some of you were here for, physically here for. And the reading is from Holly Ulbrecht's book, The Fellowship Movement, A Growth Strategy and Its Legacy. And instead of doing, here's the reading, here's the sermon, I'm going to sort of go back and forth. Like, here's a little piece of this really deep historical stuff, and this is what it might mean for us, and then go back and forth. And the first installment is really historical, which gives us an overview of what this fellowship movement was, and maybe an understanding of how our community became to be named as it is. In Ulbricht's words, between 1948 and 1967, the main growth strategy of the American Unitarian Association and its successor, the Unitarian Universalist Association, was to plant small, autonomous lay-led congregations just about anywhere 10 or more religious liberals could be brought together. This large-scale experiment in church growth was both unique in the American religious landscape and controversial. She found that about 40% of the hundreds of little lay-led congregations planted from Cape Cod to Alaska and from Minnesota to the Virgin Islands survive in some form. 30% of the UUA's current congregations, at the time of writing was 322, started as fellowships. Wow, 30% during these two decades. Some are still small and lay-led. Others have evolved into full-service congregations with buildings, ministers, and religious education programs. Fellowships introduced our religion to thousands of people and hundreds of communities, even as they challenged traditional Unitarian Universalist churches to change in often radical ways. The fellowship movement was a conscious and a nationally supported program to increase membership in our faith by promoting a large number of small lay-led congregations. And that movement happened to coincide with the time period when our congregation was formed, right? In the early 1960s, a small group of people began meeting together Sunday mornings and became an informal fellowship of Unitarians. Do we have any of those people here in the mid-60s? Not quite. Close. Marion was here in the mid-1960s, when this group was an informal gathering. And in 1966, the group organized as the Greater Norristown Unitarian Fellowship, adopted a set of bylaws, and joined the Unitarian Universalist Association. Space, including spacious classrooms for religious education, was leased in a private school for Sunday meetings. And within a few years, membership had grown to 45, mostly young parents, with 25 to 30 children. It sounds like a lot of work, Marianne. A lot of kids running around. The programs of the fellowship included social activities, discussion groups, as well as Sunday morning meetings with average attendance of 50 people. That's similar, including representatives of local press and other non-members from the community. In 75, we relocated to the YWCA, and in 76, moved to a historic rural one-room schoolhouse on Level Road. And in lieu of paying rent, this is really interesting because this aligns with the movement and aligns with who we are. In lieu of paying rent, the members did extensive renovations in that building. The 70s and early 80s saw a number of changes, and attempts were made to purchase property but were not carried through. Eventually they were, but were not carried through at that time due to a lack of support from the declining membership. This is in the 70s and 80s. And at this time, the name was changed to Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. In 1983, the fellowship moved to the Audubon School, which had parking space and classrooms. And membership continued to decline to a low of 29, and the religious education program was discontinued. Now, after much research and many meetings with a consultant from the district, the members were surveyed, and in 1987, a quarter-time minister was employed, Reverend John Morgan. And if you want more about that, ask some of the longer-term members about what exactly that looked like, being lay-led and saying, do we want a quarter-time minister? What would that look like? How would that change who we are? And the reason I'm going so much into our history is that knowing where we come from, institutionally, personally, knowing where we come from helps us know who we are today, and it helps us move forward, how we want to live for tomorrow, individually, institutionally, right? Our community's history parallels and is informed by the national movement which created us. So we look at our past. We look at our past and we see the positives. We see the negatives too, right? Here's another anecdote from Ulbricht. 40 years after the formal end of the fellowship movement, judgments about its success and growth strategies still run the spectrum from widely positive to extremely negative. Still, and you can find that today. The positive view maintains that the congregations planted as lay-led fellowships between 48 and 67 saved Unitarianism from near extinction and converted a regional religious movement into a truly national one. Along with the growing the denomination, fellowships brought innovation, vitality, lay leadership into a religious community greatly in need of fresh air. Now, on the other end of the spectrum is the view that the fellowship movement spawned small, introverted, even hostile groups that did not want to grow or welcome newcomers, did not identify with the larger denomination, and represented Unitarian Universalism in ways that did not reflect the larger movement's self-understanding. She says, neither of these views is entirely correct, and yet both are. Oh, that's truth-telling, right? I mean, that's truth-telling right there, because even though this is about the movement in general, we can look at ourselves and see some similarities. We can see some parallels drawn to our lived reality here at Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, right? If you look at how we do religion and how other congregations do religion, you will see some of what's mentioned here. We have innovation. We have vitality. We do things differently. We have lay leadership, right? There are some congregations, larger, smaller, the same size, which don't have as much volunteer support, and they need more professional staff to operate. Mainline Unitarian Church, I grew up there, that's how I know it, in Devon, PA, they were formed in the late 1950s, so also under the fellowship movement. They currently have 500 members, and they pay staff to provide refreshments on Sunday morning. That is very different from us. I'm not saying that that's better or worse. I'm saying that is very different from us, right? Some congregations don't have any member-led services. Can you imagine if we had no lay-led services? I mean, not only would the worship costs go up, but it would change the very fabric and identity of our community. Most of our services are done by not me, which is wonderful. Our congregation has strong lay leadership and strong sense of shared ministry. I mean, you've heard this. I say this a lot. I'm one minister here among many. You each do important and meaningful ministry. TPUUF is not defined by the minister, and in my mind, that is a good thing. But we also have some of the negative, too, the negative points which were mentioned. And I find this especially telling when we look at our engagement with the Unitarian Universalist Association. That's our national organization. We don't send a huge amount of members to our national gatherings. We have a yearly general assembly. We don't send huge amounts of people there. Other congregations do. We have hard times communicating with the professional staff there. I'm looking virtually at our vice president, who I know has a especially hard time, and I have had a very difficult times trying to have communications with the staff at the UUA. Sometimes it feels like we're ignored, or they give us advice which is meant for a larger congregation. It's like, do you care about the smaller? Do you care about us? Do you just care about them? And it requires more work from our lay leadership to support my ministry. Oh my gosh, they require something else from the board to make sure that Andrew is doing the ministry he should be doing. Why? Right? And then when large decisions are made, like the recent bylaw change with the UUA, it changed some portion of how we define ourselves, we here at Thomas Paine don't always agree, don't always feel heard by that national organization. And since that vote, I've heard some people say here that this community is important. Being here, being at Thomas Paine is important, and not identifying with the UUA, not identifying even maybe with Unitarian Universalism. I'm trying to name this without judging. This isn't bad or good. It's just some of our history. We aren't as anti-establishment as some other congregations. There are Unitarian Universalist communities who vocally do not trust the UUA and refuse any contact or support. The last congregation I was with, we had a guest speaker from the UUA. He was a UUA staff person. He came in and greeted the person, or a greeter at the front door, and said, "Nice to meet you. I'm from the UUA." And their response was, "We don't trust the UUA." I was like, "You're greeting someone like that?" I was like, I mean, it was obvious what that reaction was. They did not trust the UUA, and they all knew it, and they were vocal about it. Wow. That's not us. That's not us. Now, some here may say, it's good not to have a strong national connection. We don't want to have a strong national connection. We don't want them to define us. We want to be our own people. We want to be our own community. And some here might say, well, we could really use some more support. We should go more to the General Assembly. We should be more involved with our national group. I'm not going to advise one way or another. What I would say is, what I say with most of ministry, with most of life, is that we are mindful about how we are interacting with the UUA. We are mindful about whether we want to be more or less connected, and we're mindful about our history and our future and what we want to be. I mean, internally, here's what I'm talking more, that was external, now bring it more internally. Fellowships in general, and Thomas Paine specifically, tend to be talked about in terms of feeling like a family. I mean, who has ever heard or said that sentiment? We say, TPOF, with all our social events, with our potlucks, the lay-led services, it feels like a family. Right? I mean, has anyone heard or said that? I mean, or felt that? I mean, it feels like a family, right? And that's good, because a family emotion, a familial emotion, speaks to the intimate connections, right? At some congregations, I couldn't just ask, oh, what do you think about a new name? Oh, Phil walks up, oh, I know Phil. Most people here know Phil, and I'm going to say what his new name is. I can name people. At a congregation of 500, that isn't possible. It's just too big. You can't get as intimate. You can't know people as well. I won't recognize everyone coming together on Zoom. We're much more intimate. But the other side of being a family, it's very hard to join a family. Right? It's very hard to join a family. Families are close-knit groups with ways of acting that may feel strange to outsiders. I mean, think about meeting a close friend's or romantic partner's family of origin. I mean, the in-laws, the classic example, like the in-laws. And I bet there are some things done differently from your family of origin. None of which was explained in a handy pamphlet. It's like, oh, you're marrying into the Weber family. Here's a pamphlet about how we do our dinners and like what's expected of you and where to put your shoes on the stairway or not. I mean, like, right? We all have these weird things that our family does and we think it's normal until we meet another family. And that's what we do. We have lots of unspoken rules in families. Rules of behavior that are only learned through immersion, through misstep. And there are pros and cons of having Thomas Paine feel like a family, right? We're so intimate, but sometimes you may come in and you're like, why are the hymnals back there? Well, there's a history of why we do things and how we do them, and there is no pamphlet of why we do everything, right? So is there a way to ensure the intimacy, to ensure the comfort, while still putting forward a truly open, a truly welcoming invitation? Oh, yeah. There are great positives to having the history we do. And there are some difficulties and growing edges that we might want to look at the history we have. It's history for us as a fellowship, the history for Unitarian Universalism as a faith. The movement, the fellowship movement, which we are partially defined by, and our start as a community, came right before the consolidation of Unitarians and Universalists. Now, this is the history in our name, that in the United States, the two liberal and somewhat parallel faiths of Unitarianism and Universalism consolidated in 1961. So you get more history here. Now, if we go back to Ulbrich, we hear a slightly different view about what happened in 1961, which is really interesting. The common understanding of the merger that created the Unitarian Universalist Association is that two bodies came together. That's my common understanding. But with lay-led fellowships accounting for almost 40% of Unitarian congregations at the time, it may more accurately be viewed as a blending of three partners: Unitarian churches, Universalist churches, and lay-led fellowships from both denominations. Like the three wise men in the Christmas story, each partner brought their own unique gifts to the union. At the risk of oversimplifying, one might say that the Unitarians brought the voice of reason. The Universalists brought the blessing of tolerance. And the Fellowships brought the gift of freedom. When applied to Unitarian Universalism after the merger, each of them is a blessing that also carries a shadow side. The shadow side of freedom, the gift of fellowship culture, is anarchy, right? A lack of order and structure, the inability to create or sustain a center. And those qualities remain the major danger facing lay-led fellowships. When each person is free to create his or her own religion, there's no grounding, no common core, right? So we need to hold up our religious experience and understanding to the test of reason. We need to be encouraged to listen to the voices of others with openness and tolerance. It's interesting, actually, when I meet with other clergy and I tell them the name of where I'm serving, there is sometimes a reaction because they know some of this history and they know the shadow side. Like, oh, I'm serving at Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. Did you just say fellowship? Oh my gosh, they must be a really anti-ministerial, difficult congregation. Like, no, they're not all like that, but there is, just with that name, there is an idea. And there are people and there are congregations who are very anti-ministerial. It's very interesting about that. So we have good and bad history. That's true for any institution. That's true for any individual here, right? The question is what you do with that knowledge. Don't whitewash it. What do you do knowing about your history? What do we do presently? What do we know, do going into the future, knowing where we came from, knowing who our parents were, what they did that we are proud of, what they did that we would rather they not have done, right? Here's the great news. The great news is we don't have to be tied down by our history. We don't have to be tied down by our name. Looking at our past and our heritage helps us know who we are, helps us know our strengths, and helps us know our weaknesses. Looking at our past also helps us know how to move forward in the future. And it's only with an understanding of who we are, who we used to be, that we can start to live out the vision for the future. The vision you have yourself and the vision you're holding for this community. Yes, we are called a fellowship. Yes, that means something for our history. That means something for our identity. For some people, that title is one of the most important things about this community. We are a fellowship. And for others, it could be changed, and it wouldn't really matter. I am not proposing changing our name. I am not going to step into that. But I propose that we learn from our history while not constraining ourselves because of it. From the great prophet William Shakespeare, "'Tis but thy name that is my enemy. Thou art thyself, not a Montague. What's a Montague? Oh, by some other name. What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. So Romeo would, were he not Romeo called, retain that dear perfection which he owes without that title. What's in a name? That which we call a fellowship by any other name would be as empowered. So T-Puff would, were not T-Puff called, retain that dear identity which we owe without that title. The crux is here is to look with a strong and opening and inquiring mind of who we are and to hold on to what is good, right? This is a sermon for the whole congregation as we look at our identity, but it's also for each one of you personally. I know there are things in my life, my parents' lives, my grandparents' lives, which I embody. And the best thing for me to do is look at my history, to look at the great ancestors who brought me here and hold on to what is good. And to try to work on that which my ancestors left for me as challenges. It's only by acknowledging my past and present can I know how to use my strengths and work on my weaknesses. And this parallels our monthly worship theme of invitation. Yeah, to look at how we can be invitational as a community, right? We don't want to be a closely knit family with no openness. We want to be invitational, but also what we invite into our lives. In the newsletter, I've been introducing spiritual practices. I don't know if anyone noticed that. You can all just say, oh, yeah, we saw that. And in September, I said, our spiritual practice is to invite something into your life. And it can be inviting back in some piece of your history. I want to be more like my grandparents, who were very calm. And institutionally, we may want to invite in that fellowship identity of lay leadership and ownership while letting go of the fellowship identity of impenetrable intimate boundaries. We all need to move forward, mindful with the good, recognizing the difficulties. So let us embrace our history while not letting it constrain our future. Now, in conclusion, Ulrich speaks about what has been a powerful benefit from the fellowship movement. I think it's good to end here. Perhaps the greatest gift of the fellowship movement is that it held up a mirror to Unitarianism, then to Universalism, and finally to itself. Traditional Unitarianism and Universalism were challenged to reflect on their style and operation and to incorporate some of the positive dimensions of a fellowship culture. As a result, Unitarian Universalism today reflects a number of changes that can be credited to or blamed on the fellowship movement. Today's popular small group ministry program, for example, owes some of its ancestry to the culture of intimacy in small fellowships. So does the equally popular concept of shared ministry, right? Highly participatory morning worship services have spread from fellowships to the more traditional Unitarian Universalist churches. Some of those changes welcome, some of them resisted. Unitarian Universalism is alive and well in the 21st century due in no small part to the fellowship movement. It's a livelier, more vital, more diverse religious movement because of the pioneers who took the faith to new places and created a frontier kind of religion. Just as the frontier in the American West settled into established communities with a scattering of ghost towns, so likewise did these pioneer settlements. But change took place among the senior partners in Unitarian Universalism as well. The entire movement absorbed some of the empowerment of the laity, modified its forms of worship, experimented with new ways of being in community, and appreciated the value of small communities within the larger whole. We have not only been challenged, but enriched, revitalized by the unique phenomenon of the fellowship movement. Know thyself. Be aware of who you are and what Thomas Paine is. For when we do that, we can make informed, mindful decisions about how and who we want to be in the world. There's an answer to your question. Amen and amen. Let us now sing as a reflection a song on faith and diversity, 194, Faith is a Forest.
Speak through me.
We are a fellowship and a community, a family of relationships and friendships. By any other name, we would still hold love and care for each other as the burning ember of our purpose. We embody the importance of care for each other each week as we put aside time for sharing the matters of our heart. If you have a sorrow or joy which overflows into our beloved community, I invite you to come forward and share.
So we will bring this time of sharing to a close. We're going to sing Spirit of Life, the
As with so much in our community, this is also a varied time when we invite ourselves into a time of prayer. Today we'll just have silent meditation, and you can internally approach this however is meaningful for you. Please pray with me. Amen. As our service comes to a close, we can rise in body and spirit once more to sing our closing hymn, 131, Love Will Guide Us.
Love will guide us, peace has tried us, hope inside us will lead the way. On the road from greed to getting, love will guide us through the hard night. If speak before thousands. You can give from deep within you. You can change the world with your love. Love will guide us. Peace has tried us. Hope inside us will lead the way.
We end with these words. Keep alert, stand firm in your faith, be courageous, be strong. Let all that you do be done in love. Amen and blessed be.